Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Smith, Judge Rodenberg, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Court of Appeals, and welcome to wherever you are. We're virtually presenting the argument today, as the parties are aware. We are not in the Minnesota Judicial Center because of the ongoing declaration of emergency. And so we are entertaining these arguments by Zoom. And I state that for the record and to remind counsel that although we can see each other, including our names on the screen, we are only recording our proceedings audibly, not visually. So you'll need to state your name as you commence each leg of your argument. And if there's ever any indication that you can't hear or see anyone else in the proceeding, go ahead and somehow flag us and we'll pause so that we can make sure the technology is brought up to speed and no one is missing any part of the presentation. With that, just a reminder that each will have 15 minutes to present your argument with 5 extra minutes for appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that for rebuttal. And appellant's counsel, you may proceed whenever you are ready.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me?
Just fine.
I can be heard? Okay. Thank you. May it please the court. I'm Julie Nelson, and I represent the appellant, Nugai Zhang, in his appeal from his convictions for second-degree murder. There is one issue before this court. Did the district court commit reversible error when it sustained the state's Batson challenges to Mr. Zhang's peremptory strike of 2 Asian jurors? In order for Mr. Zhang to be entitled to a new trial, this court need only find that the district court erroneously sustained one of the 2 peremptory challenges. Under the Batson test to determine whether or not the strikes were proper, there are 3 steps. First, the state in this case, the opponent of the strike needed to make a prima facie case of purposeful discrimination. And there are 2 parts to that. One or more members of a racial minority had to have been peremptorily excluded. And 2, the circumstances of the case must raise an inference that the exclusion was based on race. And that's the part I want to focus on step 1, because that simply did not exist in this case. This case was about 2 rival gangs at a festival. Everyone involved was Hmong. And one gang, they got into a clash, one gang member shot another gang member of a rival gang. This does not raise an inference of racial undertones. It simply does not. It would be a different situation if, for example, the rival gangs were of different races, then perhaps you might have something. Or if Mr. Zhang, for example, had been, even if everyone was still Hmong, but the person he shot had been an innocent bystander or been there with a family member or something like that, then you might see that you would expect that other Hmong members of that community might want to support the state in its prosecution of Mr. Zhang. But you don't have any of that here. Everyone was Hmong. So we don't have that. I think that the state fails on step 1. There was no challenge to step 2, which is where the proponent must provide a race-neutral reason for the explanation for the strikes. There was no challenge there. So we go on to step 3, which is that the burden goes back to the state to prove that there was a pretextual of underlying motivation to discriminate. And again, that involves 2 steps. 1, the proffered race-neutral reason was not the actual reason for the strike, okay? And 2, that the real reason was the prospective juror's race. And here again, I think the state fails on both parts. The proffered reason for the strikes of jurors 3 and 26, and those are the 2 that we're focusing on here, is 3 and 26, is that they were not as engaged as other members of the veneer panel. They didn't say, you know, they said that they did not answer questions. They were more withdrawn. Juror 3 in particular seemed to be looking off, wasn't engaged, wasn't paying attention to other jurors when they were being asked questions. And that is a legitimate reason. This court in State v. Campbell has said so. You can look at that. This court has said that basically jury selection is an art. It's not a science. What attorneys feel, how they look at a veneer panel can be something that one attorney might view, another attorney may not. So it's not a science. There's not a particular points you have to tick off, okay? Those were legitimate reasons to strike those two jurors. The court found that it wasn't, but the court was wrong. The court compared, for example, that the attorneys didn't strike juror number 10, who the judge found also was not as engaged. But the judge missed something, and understandably so, because when the judge was reviewing the case, perhaps he didn't have the transcript. Assuming he didn't have the transcript, he couldn't really review it the same way that we can on appeal. And so, for example, comparing juror number 26 to juror number 10, he said, well, they're very similar. If it was the real reason for striking those jurors was because they were less engaged, well, juror 10 wasn't as engaged, but that's not true. During the state's voir dire, juror 10 volunteered answers. And that shows a level of engagement. That shows an interest in participation in the voir dire process. That shows someone who is going to be interested in deliberating and is going to offer ideas.
Well, that's an interesting point. But so you're saying there's something in the record that we can see that the district court may or may not have recalled, but there's also something in the record that the district court would be aware of that we can't tell from a cold record, which is the demeanor of the jurors as they're being questioned. And it seems to me the district court is in a much better position than we are to get a sense of who is and who is not as engaging as the others. Which way are they looking? Who's looking at their watch? Who's looking up at the clock? Who's thumbing through their papers or looking through their possessions? I mean, these are things that we can't be aware of and the record wouldn't reflect. Am I correct about that? And if so, how does that bear on the analysis?
Well, you are correct to a point. Absolutely. We weren't there. The other parties were. But at the same time, in any trial, there are an awful lot of moving pieces all the time. And voir dire is no exception to that. You have a lot of people in the courtroom. People are moving about. The judge is no doubt looking at other things, not simply what's going on specifically right in front of him and specifically right in front of each of the attorneys. One person might gauge as being engaged in something and one person might say is not, is subjective. If the court was correct that the real reason for the strike was because of some sort of belief, the defense attorneys had some sort of belief that someone who was tied to the Hmong community might have some sort of sympathy for this case, then surely juror 28 should have been struck instead. Juror 28, when he was questioned, he was some sort of contractor and he had work within the Hmong community. And he had talked about how he had positive experiences in the Hmong community. Why wasn't juror 28 struck then? That simply would have made far more sense and would have been far more supportive then of the state's argument and of the court's findings versus juror 10. So Your Honor, yes, while the court was there, I would still say the court could not necessarily have seen everything. No one can in a courtroom. There's a lot going on. It was the defense attorney's overall impressions when it came to jurors 3 and 26, that they were not engaged as others. And keeping in mind, this is not engaged as others. It's not saying that they weren't engaged at all. They simply were not engaged as others. And the court never addressed that concern in its findings. It simply said they were engaged. They tried. They listened. They gave answers. Well, that's true, but it still doesn't address the concern. And this is even after the district court did agree to some extent that juror 26 in particular may not have been engaged as others, as much as others were. So there was sort of that finding there. It wasn't very strong. Importantly, very importantly, even if this court were to agree that they hit the first prong of step three, which is to show that the race-neutral reason proffered was not the real reason, they still failed to prove that the real reason was indeed race. And as the defense attorneys pointed out, what reason would they have to get rid of all of the Asian jurors among jurors on this panel? There simply wasn't one, because this wasn't race related. Race
can
never.
I ask a question about that, yes. And it sort of goes to the first part too about the inference, whether there's an inference under step one. Is the thing that's troubling about it is it seems to be like. I mean, is there the argument that you're suggesting is, well, if all the players here and the context was Hmong, that there could be no inference of racial discrimination because that wouldn't be reasonable to think that. But the discrimination is not reasonable. I mean, it seems problematic to conclude there's not discrimination because there wasn't a reasonable basis to discriminate. What does that mean with respect to inferences? I mean, the discrimination on basis of race is simply not a reasonable thing.
I understand. I think I understand your point, Your Honor, because discrimination is not reasonable in and of itself, right? Okay. But I think when you're looking at the case and what Batson requires and what our case law requires is point to something in the case that would at least suggest that there is discrimination here. In the cases that we have, we can show a difference between a race difference between the victim and the defendant, or like in Campbell, there were actually racial slurs, something that would suggest that race was an issue, or even perhaps, and there was no question about this during voir dire, does anyone have any biases here against the Hmong community? That was not even brought up one way or the other. So there's just, while I understand and I agree with Your Honor that discrimination does not make sense to begin with, there's no basis for it, there has to be something to be able to point to in the record, something to point to in this case that would suggest that.
And if something could not be the nature of the witnesses and or the victim or the context of rival Asian gangs, because you're saying, well, that wouldn't be reasonable to think a juror would feel X about that. And that's where it's sort of, that's the problem for me, I guess.
Well, except that so it's not reasonable. Well, what is the basis for striking, or what the court believes the basis for the striking of 3 and 26 was, because they were Hmong and because they'd be more favorable to the state. But that's not even their reason. Okay, if this makes sense, why would those Hmong jurors be more favorable to the state? Everyone was Hmong. Everyone there was Hmong. So wouldn't the jurors then have to have had, those two jurors had to have had some sort of discriminatory purpose?
I guess I'm troubled by your argument because it seems to be inconsistent with the usual approach to Batson, which is a concern that a lawyer has decided that the lawyer doesn't want a certain class based upon race or ethnicity among the jurors. And so I don't know of case law that requires us to get into the the lawyer's head to get a sense of why it is that the lawyer wants to exclude the race, which is why the case law analyzes it based upon inferences of racial discrimination. If the question is racial discrimination, then the motive of as to the racial discrimination doesn't really matter, does it?
But there has to be something that shows that that was the reason. I mean, that is what step three, prong two of step three of Batson says, is that there has to be some showing that the real reason for the prospective jurors was the reason for the strike was the prospective jurors' race. And this, that is on the state to prove. That isn't on the defense in this case to prove that it wasn't, because then this is exactly what the Supreme Court has been concerned about. You cannot make the proponent of the strike prove a negative. How can you? So you have to be able to point somewhere in the case, somewhere, something that would suggest that this was the reason for the strike. And I don't think you have that here. That is what this, that is actually what the state, what the case law requires.
But the district court didn't buy the argument that there was some race neutral basis, because the race neutral bases were rejected because the district court said, look, I've looked at the jurors and your assertion that they're not being attentive or as attentive as others is just, the district court apparently found that to be an implausible basis. And therefore you go back to the inference, don't you, that you just...
No, absolutely. No, I disagree, Your Honor. The corollary to not believing... I'm about to run out of time if I can just finish my answer.
Please.
Okay. The corollary to not finding or not believing that the proffered race-neutral reason was not the actual reason, the corollary to that is not to find that then the real reason was race. Again, that puts that burden, the onus, back on the defense in this case to prove that it wasn't. That is for the state to prove, and they have not done that here. That is a finding that the court needed to make, and it never came up with a reason, a reason that you could point to that was supported by the facts, that was supported by the case, that would suggest that.
Thank you. Although your time has expired, my clairvoyance and the fact that Judge Rodenberg had unmuted himself gives me the indication that he might have a question, and I want to make sure he has an opportunity to ask it if he does.
You're assuming that I didn't just push the button by mistake. I actually kind of do have a question of Ms. Nelson, and I may revisit this question with Mr. Raggetts when he's speaking. And I have a question about whether an argument was made to the district court. That is the question of race versus ethnicity. It seems to me, as I understand the record, there were only three Asian prospective jurors, correct?
There were actually four.
You were four?
There were four. The state removed one first, moved for cause.
Okay. Another way of asking it more directly to the point, there were no people who were Asian who were Chinese or of Japanese ethnicity, or there were no other Asians on the group other than people who were Hmong by ethnicity. Is that right?
We don't know. That was never established. All we know from the juror profile list is that those four jurors, there were four jurors who identified themselves as Asian. Whether they were Hmong or Chinese or anything else was never asked.
Well, was the argument made by the defense, by the appellant, to the district court that this wasn't a race-based, these weren't race-based strikes. They were strikes based on ethnicity involving a cultural celebration involving that ethnicity.
No, that argument was not made.
Okay, thank you.
You will have an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal, Ms. Nelson, and we'll turn to the state.
Thank you. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Thomas Raggetts. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I represent respondent, state of Minnesota, in this matter. I hope this morning mainly to address any questions this court has on this case, but there are four key points I'd like to make in response to appellant's reply brief. I want to start, however, with just a general point. Appellant has the burden here of establishing that Judge Ireland clearly erred. He attacks Judge Ireland's analysis as superficial, but it isn't. Judge Ireland took his time here. He did research. He thought about this. He was careful. And case law clearly establishes that his credibility determination, which is essentially a factual determination, is entitled to great deference. This court's ruling in this case will affect not just defense attorneys, but also prosecutors, and it should not undercut judges' abilities to rely on their own observations, to make credibility determinations, and to enforce Batson. So moving on then to the four key points I want to make in response to the reply brief. Appellant argues that the state didn't prove these jurors were Hmong. Well, the defense agreed they were below. That's page 456. When you agree to something, you don't get to then on appeal say, well, but the state didn't give facts to back it up. Judge Ireland essentially made a factual determination here that the defense never challenged below. And if you look at page 1203 of the transcript, juror number three there is referred to as being Hmong. And if you look at the jury questionnaire, juror number 26 said she's a member of the Hmong Baptist Church. So the record supports Judge Ireland's determination here. Appellant has the burden of showing it's clearly erroneous, and appellant can't meet that burden. And I also want to correct a misstatement made in the reply brief and again today that the record shows the state struck an Asian juror. That's not true. Look at page 104 of the transcript. There was a bench conference, and then that juror was excused because, as Judge Ireland said, that juror was arguably a witness. The record doesn't say the state moved for cause. It seems most likely that the parties just both agreed this person's arguably a witness. We can't have him on the panel.
But or the court. Or the court sua sponte can raise the question of cause as well.
Right. And all we have here is a bench conference that wasn't recorded. We don't have any note of the defense objecting to the juror being struck or anything like that. So what we have here is a pattern. We have all three remaining Hmong jurors struck by the defense. Now, that is very relevant to step one. Under Angus, it's not relevant to the third step because one of the strikes was upheld. But at the time of step one, the prima facie case, Judge Ireland didn't know what the reasons for these strikes were. He just had to find a pattern. And clearly there is a pattern when all three remaining Hmong jurors are struck. And I also want to go to this argument that there was no possible racial issue in this case. All of the state's key witnesses were Hmong. And if you look at the defense closing argument, it's striking how aggressive it is. The defense essentially claims they're all lying. Every single one of these Hmong people, jurors you've heard of, is a liar. You shouldn't believe them. Appellant didn't testify, so the defense didn't have to worry about that there being some sort of spillover effect and the jurors not believing appellant either. The argument was all the Hmong people you've heard from are liars. So you can see a reason there why they might not want any Hmong people on the jury. And appellant says, well, we have no record to support that. Well, no defense attorney is ever going to admit the reason for making a racially based strike or for violating Batson. That's always going to be something you have to infer from the circumstances. And that is what Judge Ireland expressly did here. He expressly found that the strikes here were based on the impermissible notion that Hmong jurors would not be good for the defense. So that's the finding that is entitled to great deference under this court's case law. And so that was point number two. Point number one was these jurors were Hmong. The record shows that Judge Ireland found it. Point number two was we have a pattern here. The prima facie case is a very low bar. Appellant acknowledges that. It's not a close call whether Judge Ireland clearly abused his discretion or clearly erred in finding that low bar met. The only real issue here is step number three of the Batson analysis. And on that step, no case law says that Batson only applies when you have a difference in race between the victim and the defendant. That's just not the case here. Again, we have a situation where the defense is essentially arguing all the Hmong witnesses are liars. And of course, the defense didn't admit that was their motive for striking, but they didn't have to.
I'm sorry, counsel, but you're suggesting a motive for it. Do we have to decide what the motive is? Again, it seems to me problematic to come up with a reasonable reason for discrimination. I mean, why should we believe that that's, or why do we need to decide that that's the reason why, the one that you're suggesting?
Well, you don't, Your Honor, but appellant's argument is Judge Ireland clearly erred here because he couldn't possibly have had a reason for finding a racial motive here. And my point is just, well, there is a possible reason here. It's not one of those cases where race couldn't possibly have been involved. And ultimately, what it comes down to is, are you going to overturn Judge Ireland's credibility determination, which, again, is entitled to great deference, and there's simply no basis for doing so on appellant's argument that he must have been wrong, because there's no possible theoretical way race could have been a concern for the defense. So that's, I'm just trying to rebut that argument here, and that's really point number three. Point number four is the Campbell case that appellant relies on so heavily, and really the only case that appellant cites for this court overturning Judge Ireland's credibility determination, is very different factually. And Judge Ross, you wrote that decision, you know this. There were seven reasons given for the Batson finding in Campbell. Four of them were irrelevant and three of them were wrong. That is not the situation here. Here, Judge Ireland relied on his personal observations, and he didn't just say, well, these jurors seem like they were okay. He said he did not observe juror number 26 or juror number three behaving in a manner suggesting disinterest. So he's not comparing them to other jurors. He's just saying point blank, hey, I've been paying attention here. I don't see anything that suggests they're disinterested like you're saying. That undercuts the defense theory that this is not a race-based decision. And judges have to be able to rely on their personal observations. Otherwise, Batson's going to be meaningless. If every prosecutor can say, I just get a weird vibe from these jurors, they don't seem like they really care or interested, if that's not reviewable, and if a judge can't reject that based on his or her personal observations, well, then Batson's never going to mean anything. Also, we have the fact here that, as Judge Allen pointed out, the defense didn't give these jurors a meaningful opportunity to engage. So that also supports Judge Ireland's determination. And again, this isn't just comparing these jurors to the other jurors and saying they're not quite as interested. The defense just didn't give these jurors the same opportunity. And appellant essentially concedes that. If you look at page 10 of the appellant's brief, appellant concedes that six of the 12 jurors didn't answer questions on or didn't volunteer in voir dire. So that's half the jury. So there's no reason to single out these two. And if you look at page 31 of appellant's brief, appellant concedes that juror 26 was asked fewer questions than other jurors. Juror 26, the defense said, well, they were concerned about her watching crime TV shows. But as I pointed out in my brief, other jurors said in the questionnaire, they watch crime TV shows, but the defense didn't get concerned about them. So jurors were treated differently here. That supports Judge Ireland's credibility determination. And perhaps more importantly, Judge Ireland's personal observations support his credibility determination. And this court's case law talks about how the credibility determination may be based on the juror's demeanor or on the demeanor of the attorney making the strike. And it may be based on things in the record that the court, things that aren't in the record or that aren't basically observable just from the cold transcript. So the case law gives great deference to judges, and appellant just relies on Campbell. But again, Campbell, the judge relied on four irrelevant facts and three wrong facts, and we just don't have that here. It's also worth pointing out that both jurors said in the questionnaire they were interested in serving. And again, as Judge Allen found, the defense never engaged with these jurors to really assess how interested they were, or if that was just something they said to be polite or something like that. The defense never challenged them as seeming disinterested or distracted. Now the defense claim as well, because they were distracted, we didn't feel the need to engage them more fully. But again, that's then an excuse that could never be reviewed. A prosecutor could always say, well, I didn't think these jurors were that interested, so I struck both the black jurors without asking any more questions because they didn't seem disinterested. They didn't seem interested. Judges have to have the ability to rely on their personal observations and rebut something like that, which is what Judge Ireland did here. So not only do you have both jurors saying in their questionnaire that they want to serve, they're interested in serving, but you also have the fact that the defense said, I didn't even notice that I struck both these Hmong jurors. Well, Judge Ireland expressly found that not credible. And when you have the defense making a not credible claim like that, it damages their credibility generally. It suggests they're trying to come up with a reason to cover up the real reason. And Judge Ireland expressly found here that this was a race-based reason. He didn't say that it was, he just rejected the reasons they gave. He expressly said it was based on the conclusion that Hmong jurors were less desirable for the defense. So that that's very relevant here. Now, appellant mentioned juror 28. Juror 28 isn't Hmong. So that doesn't really support the argument that the defense may just have not wanted any Hmong people on the jury hearing the argument that all of the Hmong people who testified in court, you know, many, many of them, they're all liars. And also appellant said, well, Judge Ireland found that juror 26 was less engaged. Well, no, he didn't. What he said was juror 26 may have been more reserved and quieter, but that does not mean less engaged. Juror 26 thoroughly answered all the questions asked of her. She may not have volunteered answers, but neither did six of the 12. And again, most importantly, Judge Ireland said, I personally observed jurors 26 and 3, and I did not see anything that suggested disinterest. And that's not really something this court can review on appeal. So in light of the case law that strongly supports deferring to Judge Ireland, and the fact that Campbell is so easily distinguishable, this court should defer to Judge Ireland. He was careful here, he was thorough, he did research, and he did not err in upholding the Batson challenges here. And unless this court has additional questions, I'll simply ask that you affirm the conviction.
There doesn't appear to be any additional questions from the panel, so thank you. Counsel for appellant, rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. I have a few points to make. First of all, I think it's offensive that the state keeps saying that the defense attorney said that all the Hmong witnesses were lying. That just never happened.
I think what he said was there was an argument that these witnesses were lying from which the inference is drawn. I don't recall him saying that the argument was expressly made.
He certainly was implying that, and that certainly did not happen. And the fact of the matter is,
what did not happen?
The defense counsel never said that these witnesses are lying because they're Hmong,
no,
or that all the Hmong witnesses are lying.
Right. I don't believe that was his argument. I believe his argument was that defense counsel argued to the jury that the defense witnesses were lying, and allowing the jurors, if they were had a racial motivation, to draw the conclusion that he's suggesting may be implied without actually stating so. He's answering the question that you were raising as to what could be the plausible reason why anyone in the defense position would strike these individuals based upon race. I think that's what he was doing.
It still has no basis in fact. And here's the problem with the argument. First of all, it was never raised below. And secondly, big surprise that defense counsel is going to try to poke holes and discredit all of the state's evidence, be it witnesses, be it forensic evidence, be whatever it is. They absolutely did do that. That's what happens in every single trial. In this case, that the form of discrediting came in the form of questioning whether or not the witness actually saw what they testified to, what position were they in, did they actually see something. It was questioning whether, for example, the co-defendant who got a very sweetheart deal here, whether or not he had some reason based on getting that deal that maybe his testimony wasn't true. Nowhere along the way did it ever suggest, though, that because they were Hmong. And bring it up to a level in this case of this was based on discrimination or that there was a racial undertone here. This case is very much like Campbell. Campbell had seven reasons. This case had four reasons. And just in like as in Campbell, the reasons offered in this case were either irrelevant in terms of things like, well, juror 3 and juror 26 were trying to answer questions and they did the best they could to answer questions. That does not, just like it did not in Campbell, it did not address these defense attorneys' concerns that these potential jurors were not as engaged as other jurors. So this is exactly like Campbell. In addition to which, One of the things that definitely does strike, I think would strike everyone in this case, and the state brought it up, was the defense's claim that, hey, I didn't realize I did that. And I will agree that on its face, when the defense counsel said, hey, we didn't realize that we had struck all the Hmong jurors or all the Asian jurors, I agree that that can raise a question. However, there are two parts to this. If that was really their reason, if defense counsel's real reason to get rid of the Hmong jurors, the three Hmong jurors, was based on their race, they certainly would never have said to the court, oh, heck, gee, I didn't realize we did that. These were intelligent, experienced trial attorneys. They would have known that removing all the Hmong jurors was a no-no. They would have known that it would have invited a Batson challenge.
And I don't understand your argument. You're suggesting that the district court was irrational in basing a credibility decision in finding in part on the implausibility of defense counsel's statement, and that somehow the judge would be irrational in concluding that it was racially motivated?
I'm just trying to put it into perspective that there's another argument to be made there, that there's more to it than that, that it wasn't as incredible as perhaps the district court made it sound. You know, again, with jury selection, with any trial, with any phase of a trial, you have a lot of moving pieces going on. And in jury selection, you've got two days of jury selection here. You had 18 jurors who were questioned independently. You have 22 jurors in front of them during.
Let me ask it slightly different way. On what basis would we make a determination that the district court clearly erred in its credibility finding as to defense counsel's statement about the unawareness of the all of the Asian jurors being struck?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Yes, on what basis would we hold that the district court clearly erred in its credibility determination as to, based upon defense counsel's representation to the court of surprise that the defense counsel had preemptively struck all of the Asian jurors?
Well, I think you can look at the district court's ruling as a whole and say that based on everything, based on all of its findings, again, that were not supported by the fact, were not supported by the case, that its credibility determination was improper, that it was erroneous. It's based on everything that the court had said. The four reasons that the district court gave were not supported by the record. Therefore, the credibility determination would have been erroneous. But even if you found that the credibility determination was credible or was supported, you still can't show, the state still didn't show, and the court didn't find. Can I finish my sentence here?
I'm about to be out of time. Yes, please do.
That the real reason for the strike was based on race. And again, it can't just be, well, if it wasn't this reason, if we don't agree with what the defense's reasons were, then it must be race. The corollary does not work. For all the reasons that we've argued for the briefs that have been submitted, appellant requests that this court reverse the district court's ruling and grant him a new trial.
Well, thank you. And thank you to both counsel for your written submissions and for your oral argument today. Very helpful. We have taken the matter under advisement. It is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period.